Greetings and welcome to Visibility with your host, Dr. Donna Maria Galbraith. You may call us to share your thoughts, pose a question, or to give a general comment by dialing area code 323-642-1562. And now, Dr. Galbraith. Greetings, listeners, and welcome to Visibility. Today is Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. And so far today, guys, it's been a pretty good day. Tonight, we have an outstanding show, and I'm bouncing off the walls like a two-year-old because our guest tonight is Dr. Elizabeth Horch Freeman, who is like a renowned expert on colorism issues. And I cannot wait to introduce her to you. And tonight, we're going to talk about her book, The Color of Love, which focuses on racial stigma and racial features, stigma, socialization, and Black Brazilian families. And she actually traveled to Brazil to conduct this study. The book is phenomenal. We'll go in and talk more about the book later. And I'm also, so that you know, tonight the book will be up on the website of the Colorism Project, with a link. It'll have its own webpage there with a link where you can go to purchase a book and learn more about Dr. Horch Freeman's research. So let me go ahead, guys, and first let me tell you a little bit about the actual show by giving you the description. The Color of Love, the whole idea of this show, first of all, it's episode 2 in the Dynamics and Complexities of Colorism miniseries. And we decided to do this mini-series to focus in on the colorism issues that are so alive and well, is the best way I can put it, not just in the United States, but in other countries as well. So what we're going to do is go through, we're going to look at the psychological, emotional, physical, and social effects of colorism on the well-being and growth of Black Brazilian girls and women. Our topics will include the racial hierarchies in families, racial features. We're going to talk about hair, light skin, dark skin. We're going to talk about how the skin color issues affect children when it comes to love, relationships, education, and jobs. We're also going to look at how skin color and other phenotypes affect the self-esteem, self-love, self-identity, self-pride, and self-respect of girls and women of color. We're going to look at and focus in on their voices, on their visibility. We're going to look at the Afro-ment, differential treatment, and cultural practices, among other topics. Now, our guest tonight is renowned researcher, Dr. Elizabeth Horch Freeman. And let me give you a little bit about her. Let me read her bio to you guys. Dr. Horch Freeman is a Tampa native and associate professor of sociology at the University of South Florida. She received her BA from Cornell University and her MA and PhD in sociology from Duke University. Dr. Horch Freeman published her first book, The Color of Love, Racial Features, Stigma, and Socialization in Black Brazilian Families, which is what we'll be discussing tonight, everyone. It was published by the University Press in 2015. The book was awarded the American Sociological Association Section on Emotions Book Award and the Society for the Study of Symbolic Interactionism Charles Horton Cooley Book Award. In 2015, Dr. Horch Freeman presented at the TEDxUSF Talk on the Color of Love. And her book is slated for publication into Portuguese in April of 2018. She has published journal articles in the Journal of Marriage and Family, Qualitative Research and Ethnic and Racial Studies, several book chapters, and published a co-edited volume with Gladys Mitchell Walther entitled Race and the Politics of Knowledge, Production, Diaspora, and Black Transnational Scholarship in the U.S. and Brazil. Dr. Horch Freeman has been awarded several grants and fellowships to support her research, including a Ford Dissertation Fellowship, American Sociological Association Minority Fellowship, and Ruth Landis Memorial Research Grant. In 2016, Dr. Hoyt Freeman received a Fulbright Fellowship to complete data collection for a manuscript entitled Second Class Daughters, Informal Adoptions as Modern Slavery in Brazil, which is based on over 7 years of ethnographic data and interviews. Without further ado, listeners, join me in welcoming Dr. Hoyt Freeman. Dr. Hoyt Freeman, welcome to Visibility.
Thank you so much. It really is a pleasure to have the opportunity to speak on your show today.
Yes, and it's an honor to have you as a guest. And I can just say this to the listeners before we get started. Guys, you have to read The Color of Love to truly understand how the light-skin, dark-skin colorism issues, the racial features are such a big issue in Brazil. And as Dr. Hoyt Freeman and I were talking prior to the show, we see some of these very issues here in the United States, as quiet as it is kept, as much as they were swept under the rug. You know, we've seen it, maybe not to the magnitude that we see in Brazil, but some of the issues do exist here in the United States. So, Dr. Hoyt Freeman, let me begin with asking you, why did you write The Color of Love?
Okay, well, thank you for your question. So, I wrote The Color of Love because I was interested in capturing the ways that Black people are impacted by racism and colorism. And so, for the most part, we consider racism as something that impacts us from the outside, from outside of our families. But I wanted to illustrate that racism, and most importantly, the hierarchies that determine which racial features are viewed as valuable and beautiful, I wanted to study how those hierarchies impact us on a deeply personal and concrete manner. And so that was really what drew me to the topic. But the next part of the question, because people often ask me this, is they say, well, why did you go to Brazil? You know, and I could have studied this question in the United States, but I went to Brazil for a particular reason. And, you know, I have to provide just a little bit of historical context to explain why.
Right.
So Brazil is really significant because outside of Africa, Brazil has the largest population of African descendants. It was the major destination for enslaved Africans during the transatlantic slave trade. And so to provide you with an idea, about 10 times as many enslaved Africans were taken to Brazil than the U.S., right? And so Brazil has this reputation of being, it developed this reputation of being a racial democracy, or what was called a racial paradise, with this idea that being Black in Brazil was great because there was no racism. Everybody was so mixed race that racism could not exist. And with this thought process, the idea was that it was the presence of multiracial and multicolored families, people with different racial features, that really was used as the evidence that, yes, racism in Brazil is not a thing, that racial hierarchies don't exist because everybody is so mixed. So what I wanted to do was focus on these families to show the really insidious ways that racism and colorism shape and influence families in ways that have long-term consequences. And so overall, for me, Brazil is interesting, but really this research is so far beyond Brazil. It's really about making global and diasporic connections between Black people around the world, right? Because I think that the shared way that Black people experience racism and colorism is politically powerful, right? And I think that is a possible path towards developing global solidarities when we realize how our experiences of our embodied Blackness really look very similar across the world. And so I'm really excited about that. And I view this project is on one hand about love, but it's also this transnational political project.
Wow, that is so interesting. I can tell you just reading the introduction of the book, I couldn't put it down. It was so, it just grabs you and it just drags you in and you cannot, I mean, it'll, when I was reading it, I'm like, okay, where are my enforced logical limits here? I know I need to get up and do A, B, C, or D, but I'll read one more page and then I'm going to stop. So you did an outstanding, you know, outstanding job with this book, and I highly recommend it. It's wonderful. So let me ask you this. While you were conducting
thank you.
The interviews, the research, you're in Brazil, did all of that, you know, the research, you know, the interviews and actually writing The Color of Love. Did it change you in any way?
That is such a great question. And I think that, so just for the audience members, I spent over a year living in Brazil and observing the families that are at the core of my research every week, several days a week for an entire year. And I think that anytime somebody does long-term research where you spend over a year observing and interviewing families, inevitably it changes you. But for me, Brazil was also really special because I had to change in order to be able to be the type of, to collect the type of data that I did. So usually when we're trained in the U.S., we're trained to be these distant researchers. But in Brazil, the families did not trust me if I weren't involved in their family. So they wanted me to cut fruit for the mango salad, and they wanted me to help out with homework. And I ended up doing young girls' hair. And that was, for these families, they wanted to see me engaged and involved in their community in order to be able to trust me with these really intimate narratives that they shared. And so that was important because what that showed to me, the ways in which these families work together, they really revealed to me the importance of these large extended families. And I have a large family already, but in Brazil, I thought it was really powerful to see non-biological families working together, people really having a broader sense of what family could be and really working together in a way that shows how important villages are, right, to raising children. And as my book suggests, that can be good, but it can also be a negative thing if the village is also reproducing these negative ideas about blackness, right? So it's complicated.
That's true. That is so true. Did you, when you were there, how did you get acclimated and fit in? How did you make that transition from, you know, living in the U.S. into Brazil and feeling, you know, actually feeling comfortable and just fitting in? How did you do that?
That's a really great question. And that took some time. But let me also say the state where this research is collected is Bahia. So I conducted research in Salvador, Bahia, and that state is considered the blackest state in Brazil. So physically, I looked just like any other black Brazilian woman. People did not know I wasn't Brazilian, and that actually helped me tremendously. Families and kids in particular were kind of curious about me because they didn't understand how I looked like them. And I spoke Portuguese, but I wasn't from Brazil. You know, it didn't make sense to them that somebody who looked like them was from a different country. And I think that that actually helped because in some ways, my blackness was this way, was this thing that we all shared. But my Americanness was something that reminded them that I'd be going back. At some point, I'd be leaving Brazil. And I think that that gave people more freedom to share with me things that they probably wouldn't have shared with somebody who lived in Brazil, right? Who actually was part of the community. So I think that it worked to my advantage in many ways to be able to have those points where people connected with me, but then also the points where they saw me as this North American who was intriguing for a number of reasons.
Wow, that's interesting. Did you see any similarities in how dark-skinned women in the United States are treated, you know, with regard to the standards of beauty, the light skin preference, and et cetera, with the Brazilian women?
Oh, my goodness. So absolutely, there are connections. And I think that the connections are really where the power of this research lies. So as you suggested, so definitely standards of beauty, where the closeness to whiteness, the whiter you are, the more attractive you're seen. Absolutely. Light skin preferences in romantic relationships, in jobs, at schools. That was certainly the case. But the other thing that I also found, and like you were suggesting before, this is something that we don't really talk about as much in the U.S., but I also saw the importance of, beyond skin color, this notion of fine features. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And fine features being described as certain types of hair, right? Wavy hair versus afro textured hair, what were called fine features, smaller lips and smaller noses. Those ended up being features that people talked about much more openly than I think I've heard people talk about openly in the U.S. And I think that this is important because so often in conversations about colorism and embodied blackness, we tend to focus so much on skin color that I think that we don't give enough attention. We absolutely don't give enough attention to the ways that these other racialized features work, because believe it or not, in Brazil, in my research and actually in the research of other people, for black women, hair texture is actually much more significant or decisive in their lives than their actual skin color. So they often talk about their hair texture much more than their skin color. And so I've really, in my book, tried to hear what they were saying and really delve into how they were understanding the significance of their hair.
Well, that's interesting. Do the bulk of the women there, do they wear their hair relaxed or is it natural?
Such an important question because, you know, so Bahia is this interesting state. Like I said, it's in the northeast part of Brazil, and it has the most number of African descendants. And the women in my study largely got their hair blow dried straight. Some women wore their hair in braids, and some women wore their hair wore their natural hair. But it was much more common for me to see straightened hair. And the women who didn't straighten their hair were often women who were part of the black movement, who had been part of community organizations that had been trying to promote black affirmation. And so these women were in many ways different from the majority of the interviewees in my study. But something that's interesting, because you ask that, if you were asking about some of the similarities between dark-skinned women in the U.S. and Brazil. And one of the things that I think is so important to say is that I introduced this term that I call gendered racial bargain. And that idea refers to the fact that black women and men are faced with these decisions about how to present their bodies and how to navigate racism and colorism. And so in the book, I talk about how during job interviews, black men and women had to make these decisions about whether to straighten their hair, whether to let it be natural. And many of them chose to kind of follow the rules in order to be able to get jobs. And I think it's important to say that many of them straightened their hair, for example, not because they thought black hair was ugly or because they had internalized these ideas, but for them, they felt like they were faced with the option of either I straighten my hair or my family doesn't eat. And so I think that it's really important for us to not, you know, see hair straightening, for example, as kind of as an example of self-hatred, for example. I think that there are often very complicated reasons why black folks make the decisions that we do. And again, like I said, the interesting thing is that black Brazilian men and women talked about how they have to make these decisions about how to wear their hair. Which I think is important. That male point of view, we don't really hear much about in colorism studies, but men are also making these decisions.
That's right. They certainly are. You know, but you made an interesting point when we talk about the hair and going on job interviews, because indirectly, I think we see the same issues here in the United States, maybe not as significant as they are in Brazil, but I mean, if you just take like the hair issue in the United States with, I think there was an issue, I can't remember, it was in somewhere in Baltimore, Maryland, about 3 or 4 years ago, and my hair is a honey blonde color also. A woman was working in some restaurant, and she was told by the white customers that black women don't have honey blonde hair. There are other instances where women go on interviews.
That's right, and she had to change it. I saw that.
Yes.
I saw that.
That's right, and that's the thing that I've also noticed is that I've had friends even say to me, as a woman here in the United States, you're going to go on that interview with your hair honey blonde. I'm like, yes. Are you sure you want to do that? Maybe you should die. And there were times when I actually dyed my hair brown to go on interviews. I have done that because of the way you're perceived.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. And I wear my hair in a natural curly style now. It's frizzy. It's natural, but it's dyed honey blonde. And I have even... You know, I've gotten a lot of compliments, especially from white women and Latino women. But it's always that issue. And I think, like you said, every black person has to deal with this. Do I leave my hair straight? Do I go natural the way I like to leave my hair? Or do I have to change? Because like you said, it's about feeding your families. And here in the United States, the hair issue thing just drives, it wrecks my nerves. And I get disturbed when I read Facebook postings where I see black people attacking, black women rather, attacking other black women because they decide to wear their hair relaxed or straight or a wig or a weave. And my point is, and I wrote this poem about hair, and I always say that it's someone's preference, how they decide to wear their hair, but they are not their hair. And I think here in the U.S., they lose sight of that, especially when we start talking about colorism and the colorism issues, you know, all the issues that go along with it. But we'll talk about that later on. But you make a very interesting point of how I see the similarities there instantly. It's amazing. So let me ask
you
this.
I think something go ahead.
No, please continue.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Okay. What I wanted to ask you is that with the hair issues there, with the dark-skinned women, are they treated differently if they wear their hair naturally as opposed to relaxing it, wearing it straight, or just blowing it dry, blowing it out, as opposed to lighter-skinned women?
And for a lot of And what's really interesting is like I said, in Brazil, the texture of your hair, the way that you present your hair, can literally move you from one categorization to another. And so dark-skinned black women, and the term that's used to describe dark-skinned black women are pretas. Pretas are darker-skinned black women. And so for them to be both dark-skinned and to have afro-textured hair is considered just a huge no-no. It's almost unthinkable to think that you're going to get a job, right, with already being preta and wearing your hair naturally. It would take, and these women, what's so difficult about their lives is that they're facing pushback, not just from jobs and employment, but from their own families. And I think that that's really what I wanted to cover with The Color of Love, is the way in which the stigmatization of black racial features, it certainly does come from the outside. It stems from the outside. But the very places where we expect to have a safe haven are also places where black women's bodies are still being evaluated and policed really harshly. And what's complicated about that is oftentimes mothers and family members who are policing the bodies of black women, they're doing it because they framed it as how they're going to protect and help them. And that's what's so complicated about this. You know, the women are being hurt, but the mothers and the neighborhood moms, they have the intentions of helping. And it was really fascinating and fascinating actually to see that happen, to see that mothers are really trying to help these women with the reality of racism, but then also hurting them and making them feel less than.
That's an issue that would definitely, I believe, would affect their, you know, their self-esteem and you know, how they feel about themselves. And I don't know, I'm going to talk about that in a few, but when I noted in the book, which in the beginning, in the introduction, it was titled The Face of a Slave. So my question is, when Brazilians refer to a child as having a face of a slave, what does that mean?
When that came up in the introduction of the book, that was said by a student by the name of Anna. And she was basically stating what that meant is that to be very dark-skinned in Brazil and to look black and to be African-looking in Brazil is to be associated with being a slave, right? And this is precisely where the stigmatization of black bodies in Brazil even comes from, right? It's this image of the African that was exploited, that was abused, that was subhuman, that for a long time, and actually even now, Brazil is trying to distance itself from that image, right? So as much as I say that outside of Africa, Brazil has the highest number of African descendants, even with that knowledge, Brazil as a nation has always tried to distance itself from that history. And we see that even, this is something that you and I were talking about, in that the Wall Street Journal article that was just published about the demand for American sperm and how that's skyrocketing in Brazil, right? This is all connected to the idea that Brazilians have been socialized to want to move the country, quote unquote, forward by whitening the population. And so being dark skinned or being African looking really harkens back to these slave days that Brazil certainly doesn't want to talk about and wants to progress from.
That's interesting because speaking of that article, when I read it, I could not believe. I said, am I actually reading this? Is this real? You know, true? You know, so I checked out the sources and I'm like, well, it is that they're saying that the reason why, and this is the title of the article, listeners, the reason Brazilian women are requesting white American sperm is both heartbreaking and unsurprising. And they go on to give statistics about Brazil's the semen that Brazil imports from the United States between 2014 and 2016. And it goes to show that the donors by ancestry, 95.4% of the sperm donors were white with eye colors, eye color 51.8%. And unfortunately, the lowest number on that chart, that little scale, were black, which is 2% of black sperm donors there. And what I found was so interesting.
And that makes perfect sense, though, right? Yeah, but that makes sense given this history and given what people are looking for. And what's so funny about this article, and I say funny and I don't really mean funny, one of the things that's interesting about what happened when I went to Brazil is that when people would find out I was from the United States, almost immediately, this happened so many times, people would say, I hope you come back and introduce me to one of your blue-eyed friends so I could have a baby. Like people would joke like that, but it happened so often that I knew it was not just a joke. You know, people were really, if it were possible, they would be interested in me connecting them to this American guy who, in their minds, was blonde-haired and blue-eyed and would give them pretty babies. So this article is very much consistent with some of the things that I observed and experienced in Brazil.
Wow, that's interesting. And I know in there, you know, we've heard of movies and stories here in the U.S. where you hear black women saying, you know, well, young girls, particularly not women, saying they wanted a mixed race baby because it would be pretty with white and black. And I remember years ago, my neighbor, she was a young woman, and she said to me, Miss Donna, I want to have a baby with, I don't know if it was a Latino guy, I cannot remember, if it was white, cannot remember. And I said, well, what's wrong with you having a baby with a black man? And she said, Miss Donna, look at my hair. She said, be real. And I'm like, well, what's wrong with your hair? You know, she had nice, thick, healthy hair. And she said, I don't want to have to perm or smell a hot comb or be bothered struggling or fighting with my daughter or having to put braids in her hair. You know, and deal with this every day. And I'm like, wow, this was really deep. And she didn't get it at that time. She really, you know, just didn't. Well, I put it this way. I believe that she did get it. She was just determined that she did not want to have a child and have to deal with the hair. But I think it was deeper than that. I think she more or less wanted that child with a light complexion more than anything else in this world.
No.
And
I mean, that's right. Yeah.
It's something. Well, let me ask you, let's talk about the girls, the young girls and the teens. How are dark-skinned girls and the preteens and teens, how are they treated in Brazil?
So that is a really good question as well. I think that there are several expectations that exist for them. And the first expectation is that they will certainly not go to college, that they won't graduate, so really low expectations for their academic achievement. But the other thing is that they're also sexually promiscuous and sexually available. And this is something that I saw in various interviews. I remember I had a 12-year-old interviewee, and I believe she said this happened when she was 10 years old, where she was on a bus, and a man whispered to her gostosa, which means like delicious, but it's an inappropriate comment to be said to a child. And she says she ran home to tell her mom, and her mom said, you know what, this means that from today on, you're a woman. And so I thought it was really interesting how her interest into motherhood is contingent on her sexual harassment by a man who sees this child as someone who is sexually available. And so I think that that's very much a way that young Black girls are viewed and treated. Intelligence is not something that usually gets associated with them. And I think even more so than anything else is the idea that they are meant to serve and not lead. And not even just meant to serve, but this idea that they're born to serve and to serve white people. In fact, in Brazil, there's a saying, white woman to marry, a mulata to have sex with, and a dark-skinned woman to work or serve. So, I mean, this is literally a saying that people have in Brazil. And I think that shapes how dark-skinned girls and teenagers are treated.
Wow. Did you notice any of the girls suffering from self-esteem issues or acting out in order to get attention because of the way they
were treated? Definitely. Definitely. I mean, and you can imagine how difficult it would be to be getting these messages from all over. So when I say these messages come from all over, the messages that dark-skinned girls are not valuable, are not attractive, are not smart, these messages are coming from the billboards that never really show them, from the ways in which Black women are portrayed in the novellas as only prostitutes or domestic workers or criminals, to the way in which Black women are not represented in schools. And then when you're at home, if you're dark skinned with Afro-textured hair, you continue to be stigmatized. So you can imagine the type of impact that this can have on young girls. And one of the ways that I conceptualized this is I introduced this term called affective capital. And affective capital really, when it boils down to it, refers to the fact that when you are treated well, when people treat you well and compliment you, this actually is a way for you to get positive emotional resources. It makes you feel good about yourself. It makes you feel confident. It makes you willing to take risks because people already see you as a good person. But many of these darker skinned, women with Afro-textured hair, simply being taken from them because they were exposed to so much negativity, which led to them, instead of being confident, many of them ended up kind of recoiling. I give this example of this young girl named Elisa who took a dance class with me. And at the end of the dance, we had a final production. And Elisa knew how to do the dance perfectly. She had taught me how to do the dance. And the final day when we were going to present the dance, she didn't come up to dance. So we do the dance, and after the dance is over, I come down and I say, Elisa, why didn't you dance? You know the dance. And she said, you know, I couldn't bear getting up there. I couldn't do it. And she didn't tell me why until the next day, but she explained that in her family, she was always treated and insulted for being dark-skinned, that she didn't want to put herself on the stage for other people to see her and evaluate her in the same way that her family had. And I think that's really a perfect example of how treatment in your family then goes to shape your ability to be able to function in other situations outside of your family. And I think that's really how we see the damage that colorism can do, because it's not just you don't feel loved in your family, but this lack of love in your family then ends up shaping your ability to even form other relationships and friendships. It informs your ability or shapes your ability to be confident in situations, even when you know things. In Elisa's case, she knew the dance, but she was so, I think, really inhibited by all the negativity that it really made it difficult for her to even show what she knew.
That's amazing. Did you see many families where they had various skin colors, like hues, or like maybe some of the children were light and some of them were dark? Did that exist in a lot of the families?
Oh, yeah. No, that was absolutely the case. And in fact, the way that I selected my families is that the families that were included were families that had quite a bit of what we call phenotypic diversity. So diversity, not just in skin color, but also in hair texture, nose shape. So I was particularly looking for families where you had this type of differences in racial appearance. And one of the examples that tends to resonate with people is the example of a young 9-year-old girl by the name of Hejani. And Hejani was really, she's easily one of my favorite interviewees because she was so honest and so energetic and so smart and so cute. And her mother was pregnant when we met. And so when the mother delivered the baby, Kejani cried all day. And her mother told me to go ask her why she cried all day when the baby was brought home. And so I asked Kejani, what's going on? What's making you cry? And she said, I'm crying because of the baby. You saw her. She was born limpinha. And limpinha means clean. So the baby was born clean or light with straight hair. And she said, you know, I'm afraid of losing the cariño or the care of my family. And I think that was such a powerful moment for me because even as this young child, she realized how colorism works in Brazil. And she understands that these differences might be enough to make her family start treating her differently. And so I think that, you know, we have the example of Kejani. You had examples of men who talked about the fact that in their family, depending on your skin color, you would have some of the kids would be signed up for different enrichment activities and the other darker ones would not be. Some of them would get new clothes and the darker ones would not. One of the most interesting ones is an example that two of my respondents, Thiago and Arivaldo, they talked about the fact that I think it was Thiago's brothers who, when they came to visit, the lighter-skinned brothers would get the big fish when they were having a meal, and the darker-skinned brothers would just get what was left over, right? So even in terms of nutrition and food, skin color can play a role in what you have access to.
Wow. Unbelievable. Did you notice any sibling rivalry within families where one was dark and one was light? Were there any issues with them getting along?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. No, that was, and I found actually two things. So there were definitely rivalries where, in one case, one of the sisters told the other sibling when they would get into arguments, "You're not my sister. I'm lighter than you. I'm better than you. You were found in the trash," right? And so that would be something that one of the sisters would say to another sister as a way to kind of dig at her being dark skinned. But there was something. There were these other examples that I thought were even more interesting, where you had siblings, you had a lighter skinned sibling, recognize that the family treated her darker skinned sister differently, and she didn't like it. The lighter skinned sister didn't like it, and so as they grew up, the lighter skinned sister tried to compensate for all of that negative treatment by taking care of the darker skinned sister's children. And I thought that was a really interesting dynamic where you have this lighter-skinned sister that says, you know, this is not right. I see that you've been disadvantaged. This is my way of trying to compensate by helping you out now that you're older and helping your kids out. And so I think that those examples really show the complexity of these families, because one of the things that was clear to me is that even while there were all of these efforts to try to erase Black features, what was so amazing about these families is that they were always reproducing racism, but at the same time resisting it, right? Trying to figure out ways to navigate this difficult situation. You know, and even when I talk about families, I think it's really important for me to say there were definitely sibling rivalries, but there were also sibling relationships that led to more Black affirmation. So I have an example of two twins in the study, Ismara and Barbara. And these twins had a dad that's Black and a mom who's white. And each of them went to live with different grandparents. One went to live with the dark skin, the black grandparents, and the other went to live with the white grandparents. In the end, these siblings ended up re-socializing each other. So once one of the twins was able to learn about and value Blackness and Black hair, she convinced her sister to stop straightening her hair, to join an organization that was anti-racist. And I say that to say that siblings can have rivalries, but they can also be a really important source of support for each other. And I saw both of those things in my work in Brazil.
Wow. So let me ask you, let's say you have one sister who has the light skin, but she's very Afrocentric features. And so her hair is like maybe kinky.
Mm-hmm.
And then you may have a dark complexion, they're blood sisters now, who could be dark complexion and have like more Eurocentric looking features and the straight hair. is it that the darker skinned sister would still be given the preferential treatment because she has those European features and the silky and the straight hair, as opposed to the light skinned sister with the light skin but the Afrocentric features? Are they treated
that is
better?
That's a great question. So they would definitely be seen as different. And what families would likely say is what the family would likely say is it's sad that one of the daughters was born dark skinned, but at least, quote unquote, at least, you know, her hair is straighter, right? So that would certainly be something, a type of comment that would be heard. And in fact, one of my interviewees described herself, when you had darker skinned, very dark skinned black women who had straightened hair, some of them actually did have naturally straightened hair, and instead of being called black, they were called Indian, right? So they were like black Indians, right? The idea that you're dark skinned, but you're really Indian because you have straightened hair. But with the lighter skinned woman, what likely would happen is that she's light skinned, and the idea is that her hair can be straightened. So she's not, quote unquote, ruined, right? So,
oh, okay.
Yes, her hair is Afro textured, but if she's willing to relax it, then we can redeem her, right? The idea is that how can you redeem blackness from this daughter? And so if she ends up straightening her hair, then she would still be more privileged than the darker skinned sister with straight hair.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
It does. I get it. It goes back to that skin color and close proximity to whiteness. Interesting.
Yeah.
What about,
but if that lighter skinned sister could not, I was just going to say, if that lighter skinned sister could not straighten her hair, then, you know, it would be really interesting to look at those dynamics. But in many ways, people would see the darker skinned, straight haired sister as the more valued one.
Wow. That is interesting. It's something.
Yeah.
What about when it comes to the other like phenotypes? And for the listeners, we mean like other facial features, the nose and the lips. How do those features actually play into everything with them? Say if they had a broader nose and thin lips and maybe lighter light eyes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, these are really, I like these questions. So as it relates to nose, one of the ways in which this came out was actually with babies. And this was something I didn't expect. So I actually ended up spending a significant amount of a particular chapter just talking about babies, because I learned so much about how at an early age, babies are already being evaluated based on what people are presuming they will look like in the future. And so one of the things that was really important as it relates to babies was this idea of noses. And so one of the practices that we saw that families talked about is the idea of pinching a baby's nose and holding it down so that it can be thinner. And families often did this with a candle. So they would light their fingers above a candle to keep the fingers warm, and then they would press their fingers over the nose with the idea that it would lead to a thinner nose. This came up in almost every family, and I'd say the majority of families talked about the fact that they actually used that strategy to create a nariz fino, or a fine nose for their child. So that was really important. And of course, it comes to matter, too. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say it matters, too, in the dating market, because all of these, it's almost as though the entire constellation of features matter. So the ideal type is light skin, straight hair, and fine features. And so the person who comes close to meeting that constellation of features is the one that's going to be the most valued. So in this case, in my book, there's a woman by the name of Lilsa who has a black mom and a white dad, but she ended up with really light blonde hair, blue eyes, and very light skin. And she talks about the fact that when her mom had her, her mother's black friends were upset. Some of them who were also pregnant and had babies were upset because they were thinking, how is it possible for her daughter to have come out so light? She's darker than me, so my daughter should have been lighter, but she wasn't. So So even these ideas of comparing babies at young ages, looking at all of these features, we see this happen throughout people's lives, not just as adults, and certainly not just during dating.
That is interesting. I remember when my daughter was born, we had a neighbor. They were very close to our family. I remember she came to my home and she wanted to see my daughter. And, you know, so she picked her up and she was sitting there on the couch in the living room. And all of a sudden she said, you know, she took her, what was it, a pointer finger in her thumb, and she began pinching my daughter's nose. And I think she was from Belize. I think they're from the island of Belize. Anyway, they looked as if they were Pakistani, but they were not. And she had the straight hair, but very, very brown skin and a very, you know, slim nose. And she said to me, "You pinch the baby's nose every day and she'll have a perfect nose." And I just looked at her because I'm like, okay, there's something wrong with this woman. You don't, you know, I'm not going to pinch my baby's nose. It's going to be what it's going to be. And I laughed at her. And I remember she said to me, Ms. Hadley, she said, "No, Donna, don't laugh. You'll thank me later. You pinch your nose like this. Come here and let me show you." And she said, "You do this every day. Every day you have to do it." And I'm like, okay, this is not, something's wrong. But in her mind, she was saying, what she was saying to me was as if someone was saying to me, "Make sure you put, you lotion a baby's body down after you bathe her." That's how common it was for her to say that.
It was just common. That's exactly right. Yep.
It was no
and
thing,
actually,
but
the fact that she actually did it, because she took it upon herself to start pinching it herself, pinching your child's nose, which is
like,
really bold, but it
bold.
Does, it suggests that this is commonplace.
And she really, she was really like a little upset when I told her, you know, "Stop doing that. You know, the child can't breathe. What are you doing?" And she was a little taken back, or maybe even a little offended. But I remember I told my sister, my mom and dad, I'm like, "You won't believe what she did to Ada's nose." And, you know, then, you know, my dad told me, "Well, that's what they do. You know, they want to make sure the baby's nose isn't broad or wide." And I'm saying that's just absolutely, you know, unacceptable to me. But she did it, and it was okay. It was okay in her mind, rather than.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is what, but the interesting thing that you said is for her, it was not only okay, but she was helping you, right? Like in her mind, she let me help you out and show you how to be a good mom, right? And and that's what's so fascinating about this.
And she didn't, it didn't bother her that I was, you know, I was actually, I'll be honest with you, I was livid that she did it. But I guess, like you said, considering the culture and how they believe in the, with the nose and the hair, and then she was worried about her hair texture. And she kept, you know, making comments that,
"Oh my goodness,
you know, babies are not normally born with so much hair. My daughter was born with like a head full of this thick, straight hair." And she kept touching, you know, and I was always a very funny person with people touching me or touch, especially my daughter. And she was fascinated with her hair and she kept rubbing her hair and she said, "Oh, look, the hair is straight. She has so much hair in her head. Look at this pretty hair. And her skin is so light." And I sat there, and back in those days, you know, Dr. Hort Freeman, I hadn't even heard about colorism. I was young and I was stunned.
Right.
Because this woman was sitting in my living room, examining and inspecting my baby like it was like she was a piece of meat, and you know, actually gave her a stamp of approval that, you know, she passed the test. And I remember my dad said after that, "Well, she had to come and examine and give the stamp of approval." And then the next day, she came and brought a beautiful gift for the baby for her. And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" But she had this thing where she always said to me,
"No, but
It's sad. They don't get it." But
you know,
so
what this reminds me of is, I was just saying, what this reminds me of is I gave a TEDx talk on this book at the University of South Florida. And there were several hundred people in the audience. And the TEDx talk was with several other speakers. But after the event ended, people were allowed to come up to the speakers. And I had a line of people who wanted to talk to me. And these people, what was really so powerful about the experience is that these people, and they were largely women, were from India, Pakistan, Nicaragua, India, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and they were waiting in line to tell me that the very same things that I had talked about in my talk, they had experienced themselves.
Wow.
And so that was what was so, for me, I had never interacted with women from really all across the world, not even just Black folks, right? So when the women from Pakistan and India were talking, I just thought, this really is such an important issue for us to talk about. And I think that what I found powerful when I, in chapter two, when I talk about the babies, is exactly what you're saying, was the way in which Black babies' bodies were scrutinized, were not even human, like they were objects. And that was, I didn't expect to find that, and that was really striking for me. But at the same time, and this is something that you said, this happens in the U.S. This happened with my own son, and I've seen people do that with him. And so I think that it really is important for us to think about my book as it relates to Brazil, but also be able to think about the fact that this is not just Brazil. These Brazilians aren't crazy. They're responding to a system of white supremacy that all of us are also negotiating. And I think that the moment that we can realize how much we have in common and how much this struggle is similar and painful for many of us, I think that, like I was saying, this could really be a point of political power for us and a way for us to start uniting under our unified solidarity.
That's right. That's right. We need to. How did you feel when they did that with your son?
Oh, no. So if this is an interesting question, because the person who did it, who made these comments, was a family member. And this is such an interesting moment, right? So this was after I had collected research on Brazil. And, you know, after I came back, my husband and I, we became pregnant, had the baby. And so this was our first son. So it was interesting for me to see firsthand some of the very things that I had been researching in Brazil happen. My son was born with this head full of hair that people described as really pretty, in part because it was straight hair, right? He doesn't have that type of hair now, right? He has Afro-textured hair now. But in the malls and in the streets, people would literally stop us because they wanted to see my son and his hair, right? And, and I knew what that was about. It was about a Black baby also having this type of hair that we consider, quote unquote, good hair.
And
that same language of good hair exists in Brazil, cabelo bom. It also exists in Spanish speaking parts of the world, pelo bueno, pelo malo. And so the fact that we have these same constructions of these terms, good hair, bad hair, in three different languages, really speaks to how universal these experiences are of having our Blackness be stigmatized.
That you're right. You're so right. And I also think that, you know, that you made an excellent point with the color of love. You know, a lot of the issues we do see here in the United States. And I think that by everyone, just like the, and here's my issue with the colorism issue here in the United States. There's so many misconceptions and wrong definitions and understandings of whatever colorism here is in the United States, where sometimes when I'm reading posts on Facebook or Twitter or comments on other social media, I'm like, oh, come on. And they annoy me to such a degree I can't even respond, because I'm saying, you know, that's not colorism. Or so I think it would be good if they actually took the book, and this is just not for someone who's in a college classroom. I'm talking about average everyday people, to buy the book and read it so they can really understand what this colorism thing is, how it affects people. Mm-hmm. And your book, and I've read, like I've told you earlier, I've read a lot of the books on colorism. Your book is the first book that I have read that actually talks about and breaks this down, and talking about how the darker complexion little girls are treated, how they're sexualized early, because we do see a lot of the same issues happening here in the United States, especially with darker skinned girls, how they're treated.
That's
mistreated.
Exactly right.
I think
let me say this, and this is a bit of a,
go ahead.
I was just saying, I think that your point right there was such a good point in terms of thinking about darker skinned girls being sexualized. Because I have this new research agenda that I've been developing about human trafficking and the fact that colorism even impacts people's experiences as human trafficking victims when we're talking about black girls, right? And so when we talk about colorism, this isn't just a matter of who's loved and who's not loved in families, but this literally has an impact on job, on mortality, on arrest. Like we said, for arrest, several of my colleagues are doing work that links skin color with your likelihood of being incarcerated, and where they're comparing people in the same family and showing the darker you are, the more likely it is for you to be arrested. And so there's many different ways in which colorism matters, which is why I think that your initiative, this talk show, the website, your journal is so critical, because people still don't have a good sense of what colorism even means.
Yeah, they don't. Thank you so much. And we're with the journal, and I'll tell you one of the. Let me get back to the book first, and then I'll to the journal. The reason why I like highly recommended that everyone read the book is because when I listen to a radio show, you know, like sometimes they're clowning around in the morning, and they're talking about colorism. They're saying the things that they're saying, it's all wrong, and. You know, the average young person is going to listen to, what the disc jockey is saying on the show, or whatever they call them, the host, and they joke about it too much.
Right.
They joke about it to a fault, to such a degree that these misconceptions, misunderstandings, whatever you want to label them, about colorism is so out there in the World Wide Web that I said, when I was reading your book, and I'm like a highlighter person, and with my red pen, and I'm making notes. I'm like, oh, yes, 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 and I'm going all through it. As a matter of fact, I'm actually going to use your book when you come on the show and we talk about girls and women of color, colorism, because we need to also.
There's so much more to say.
Yes, so much about this, because, and this is why, listeners, I'm telling you, you need to read the book to understand how detrimental colorism is. And to see how especially it affects girls and women. And when we start looking at the phenotypes, the hair, the eye color, the shape of the nose, whether it's broader thin or the lips. I mean, and my point is, Dr. Hort Freeman, you hit the nail on the head, because although, like you said, this is Brazilian, the same issues are occurring here in the United States. You know, maybe not to such the magnitude
that
we see here. But so this is a must read, in my opinion. If anyone is trying to understand colorism, what it is, how it works, how it affects people, then they need to read it, because, like I said, I've read a lot of the books, and I haven't found one that breaks it down like this, where it just talks about how the darker skin child is treated as opposed to the lighter complexion. And I started working on my book on colorism, I think it was in 2009, had a sewage backup, I lost everything, so I started over. And in starting over, with the colorism, like interviewing young girls, and this was in the Baltimore, Maryland area, and women, some of the very issues that you noted in the book, as quiet as they have been kept here in the state, these young girls and women have experienced it.
Yep.
From families, friends,
no,
and
that's
education.
That's exactly right. That's
so
exactly right.
You hit the nail on the head.
Well, you know, something else that I think is really interesting, and we didn't talk about this today, and maybe we'll talk about it when we talk about women, but in Brazil, there's this idea of what's called a solidão da mulher negra, or the solitude of black women. And that idea is really about the fact that because of colorism, many dark-skinned women are never married. They're never married. They have a hard time finding the romantic relationships that they want. And this has a huge impact on just their quality of life. So you have a lot of women who end up being single mothers because darker-skinned women are seen as sexually attractive, but not somebody who you're going to have a long-term relationship with. And again,
right.
We might talk about this in our next session, but I think that that's so important for understanding the value of affection. It's not just familial affection. It's also this romantic affection and your ability to even establish a family life for yourself.
That's
so
right.
These issues are certainly issues that black women here are facing. And like you said, I think we tend to brush them under the rug because the expectation is that we're supposed to be so confident in our blackness that we're beyond this. But the reality
That's
is
right.
that we're not yet. We're not
You're
beyond
right.
this because women, we're still struggling to be able to represent ourselves. And, you know, this is kind of an odd thing to say, but this is also why I think that movies like The Black Panther, were so popular, because this is a movie where very dark-skinned black women with wide noses and beautiful lips and natural hair were portrayed as the protagonist, as strong, as beautiful, as desirable, and we haven't seen that. I mean, the sad thing is that even in Brazil, people organized viewings because they were so excited about seeing representations of blackness in this way. So I think that we're all kind of thirsty and hungry for representations of ourselves, and I think that that has to do with the way that we've experienced our blackness both in our homes and outside.
You're right. You're right. And I had more questions for you on the book, but I'm going to hold them until we do the show on Girls, Women of Color, and Colorism, because these very topics we need to actually discuss in that form, because, you know, I just find it so amazing how this book can just grab you and draw you into it. And with each page that you turn, it just can't let go. And it's so important for people to understand the magnitude, you know, of colorism. And you did it. I mean, this is like a winner. And I'm really critical.
Well, let me say this. When people, and I really appreciate the kudos, but I also have to say that this book is what it is because the families were willing to be vulnerable with me. Like, you know, I could not have written this without people really taking risks and saying things that they hadn't really said to other people before. And so the courage of the Brazilian families, the Brazilian women who took the time to meet with me over and over again, year after year, this is why I was able to produce this type of work, because this was really the result of a collaborative effort with black people who realized that this was something that was important and that they were going to really share these intimate experiences so that this project could come to fruition. So I just have to recognize those families and those women, especially who made this possible, who opened up their doors to me day in and day out, year after year, for me to do this work.
Wow, that's amazing that they actually did that. And I'll tell you what made me, when I first started off all of my project, it was just the Interracial Colorism Project. But as I noted earlier, in interviewing young girls and women, even grandmothers and men and young boys, when I pulled from all of that, when I started looking at all my notes, where I saw a great need to focus in on girls and women of color and these self-esteem issues, and where so many dark complexion young girls, and I'm talking like ages 10, 11, and 12, and maybe 13, were saying things to me, and with their mothers sitting there, looking shocked that they felt like they were not important, they weren't pretty, they were ugly. And the bulk of these little girls are beautiful little children, beautiful, but they believed because it was so dark. I'm ugly. I'm never going to get a nice boyfriend or a cute boyfriend because all the cute boys like the light-skinned girls. And I had women, grown women, telling me that my whole life I hated what I saw in the mirror. I hated my nose. My hair was always so hard and so nappy. I remember I was combing it. It broke a comb. And I've never had great self-esteem. So what happened for me, that was a turning point where I said, okay, I'm going to keep doing my colorism work. But I kind of put it on the sidebar because I saw the great need to focus in, especially for our girls, you know, to develop something that was going to lift their self-esteem, self-love, self-pride, you know, their respect for themselves, for the, you know, their body.
Absolutely.
To teach them to learn to embrace and love the color of your skin. You know, we're all diverse in so many ways, but so that's why I started doing, you know, the National Girls and Women of Color Council, because I saw they were real serious psychological, emotional, physical, and social issues that were affecting their well-being and growth. So I said, okay, we need to have something that's going to say to them, listen, you are just as important as the next person sitting next to you and so on. And I think since I've been talking, and I talk to a lot of young girls and their mothers, talk to young women and even older women, and they will all say to me, one said to me, wow, your unique calling is something else because you're not afraid to tackle it. And I told them it's not an issue of being afraid. It's an issue of you realizing that there's something really wrong and ugly about this situation and how I see people who are within my own racial category, however you want to label it, feeling as if they're nothing and they have no value. And then it was this belief, well, I have to be validated by someone.
Right.
I'm like, no, we need to back this up and
then
change it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so what I want,
this is great.
So with doing this, I was able to see so many areas where, just here, like I'm in Jersey now, and I was in Maryland at that time, where I saw so many young girls who were making bad decisions, you know, hanging with the wrong crowd, poor choices, letting their bodies and their minds, and their, like I told them, their souls be exploited. Because somebody, like I said to the young girl, some idiot or moron told you that you didn't have any value or worth, or you were nothing because of the color of your skin, or the shape of your nose, your lips, or the texture of your hair. Are you kidding me? And so I saw that need, and that's why now with all of my work that I'm doing, like I still do my colorism, but I try and focus on developing initiatives, programs, resources like this talk radio show, to say to girls and women of color, you're visible, you have a voice, you will be heard, you have value, you are important, and don't let anyone ever make you think that they are superior to you because of the color of their skin, or that you are inferior to them because of the color of your skin. And it's just, and I tell you that when I tell you Dr. Hort Freeman, it's like every day it's a new learning experience. And like now I'm putting together a program for the girls. And when I, you know, I'll talk to them, I'll say, okay, tell Dr. C this. And what I did, I built a rapport with these young women. So they trust me. They know that Dr. C is cool. But like I always tell them, you know, there are limits with it, as it is with everything. And if they share information with me that I think is something that's going to harm them, I'm on the phone to your mom. But, you know, the point I think that I'm trying to make is that when I look here in the United States and I see these colorism issues, when I see adorable little girls who are growing up believing, because of the same issues we see the girls dealing with in Brazil, as quiet as it's kept here, we see these girls getting involved and going down the wrong path because they believe, well, I'm darker complexion, my hair's not like Jane Doe's, so why bother? Why try? So my goal is to change how they view themselves.
Exactly right.
Learn to love who you are. Like I always tell them, you're God's masterpiece. We're all different. We all, you know, you have to learn to embrace and love who you are and not let this skin color, you know, the complexities of these skin color issues, you know, keep you from living a fulfilling life or achieving goals. So I explained to one mother 2 weeks ago.
No, you're absolutely right.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, one of the things I like about what you were saying is you were talking about all the ways that you are engaging online mechanisms, because I think that what we find in Brazil, and actually even in the United States, is that Black women have really carved out a space for them online to find communities that validate them, communities where they can see themselves and feel good about themselves. And it's funny because I'm working on a new project. I just got a grant to study Black women who are going natural. And part of that study is about how they're using social media, social media to find other women and to get the encouragement that they need to make this big step. And so much like you were saying with young women, and even in Brazil, folks are finding that social media ends up being this important place where they can find examples of women who look like them, who are being successful. You even have, I think you have a guest, Dr. Yaba Blay will be coming on, and she has a really great, I love her initiative related to how she's using online mechanisms to really expose people. So I think it's going to be great. And I think that initiatives like yours with the radio, with online presence, is really going to be able to leverage the power of our community to be able to make the changes that we're talking about.
And I think it's so important because let me tell you something that's so interesting too, Dr. Hort Freeman, then we'll wrap up, is that the bulk of our listeners are in the United States, but we have listeners from the UK, in Africa, we have Brazil, the Dominican Republic. The reason why I think it's so important to get this message out, especially with visibility being about the voices and visibility of girls and women of colors, because our listeners are international as well. And each week we see listener base growing and growing to the point that, I'll be honest with you, I was stunned, because I said, maybe we'll get a few listens here in the United States. Bottom line of it is, these are archived shows. They'll be here forever. And we're creating a database of all of our guests. And I'll send you, well, I have your scholar information, to have resources, scholar resources, so people will be able to identify the scholars who focus in on issues affecting our girls and women of color and go to one place to find it. But I received an email from a woman who was in the Dominican Republic who just said to me, I love what you're doing. You know, you did the colorism thing and you're blending it in with this. And then just last night on LinkedIn, a woman reached out to me. I forgot her name, doctor. I can't remember her name. But she was so excited about this colorism thing. And she was like, Dr. Horch Freeman, the book, I've read the book. And she just kept saying over and over to me, I've read the book. You don't understand. The book is so there. And I'm saying, I know, I read it myself. I sat down and I read it. But she and I had a discussion about your book. And I'm thinking about inviting her as a guest when we talk about girls and women of color with colorism. Because Dr. Horch Freeman, I could not get a word in edgewise with her, with her raving about the book, and she wanted to just, you know, go do. So I said, oh, you know, I'm writing a book review. And she goes, no, I'm going to write the book review. And I'm like, okay, we're going to have a battle over who's going to write the book review. And it was funny, but at the same time, it felt so good, because here's a woman who, I think she's from Pakistan, who read the book, who could relate to so many of the issues that she saw in this book to the girls from where she comes from, people who look like her. And then she said, this is universal. She really has something genuine here. And I said, yeah, well, she has to do a documentary or I won't be able to sit still. So I think, and we're getting the band up for you to do, to get a research grant or whatever support that we can give you here at the Colorism Project or through the National Girls and Women of Color Council. You have it 100%. Because what you've done here is that
you've so opened up,
you know, this book opens up the door, Dr. Horch Freeman, it opens up the door. It's a wealth of information and the very issues that these young women in Brazil are dealing with. We've never seen them in writing to this magnitude. And people can relate, women in other countries who are going through similar issues because of their skin color. Now they're willing to speak up and they're willing to say, well, you know, likewise, I know people in my country who've gone through this. Prior to this, you didn't see them so forthcoming. So your book is helping a lot of women realize that it's okay. And to me, when she said that to me last night and talking to other women, when I hear them say to me, and I have like a diverse group of women I talk to from like different countries. And when they say something that this helped me be able to talk about what I have seen and what I've experienced, the book opened the way. And like she said to me, it opened up the pathway. And it said to me that it's okay because you're not the only. So when she said that to me, and I said, wow, I have to introduce her to you, because it's just how she was so emotional and so, you know, sincere and honest about how she felt now.
Right.
After she read your book. And prior to reading the book,
I hope you introduce us.
Yeah, I'm going to reach out to her tonight and see if she'll be available to join us for the Girls and Women of Color episode. I'm going to introduce the both of you, because when you see something like this, Dr. Horch Freeman, and you read the book, and someone can relate and understand because they have seen something similar in their own country, like she said to me, this made me feel that it's okay now to talk about what I've been through, what I've seen.
Right.
That, to me, was the most important statement ever.
No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, and that's also one of the reasons why, for me, it was so crucial for me to have this book translated back into Portuguese. Because, I mean, these are the people who really spent the time for me to do this. And so I think they, being able to have this research be read by them, I mean, that's for me truly how I know that I've done what I needed to do, is when they can read it and say, you know what, you really capture the complexities of these experiences in my family. And so I'm really just grateful that I'll have
really
the chance
did.
To have this available to them.
You know what I'm doing? I'm putting together like a colorism curriculum through the Colorism Project. And with your permission, this is the book that I'm going to put in there, and I'll send you the whole colorism outline. Because this covers, I hope I'm explaining this well to my listeners, or I'm sounding like I'm making sense. But for my listeners, the point I'm trying to get across here is that when you read the book and you hear and you see how people are treated because of the color of their skin, you will be able to relate to it on some level and understand how colorism is so detrimental and the magnitude of it and how complex it can be. But the most important thing is that when you have others who have never been to Brazil, never experienced any Brazilian, never encountered Brazilian people here in the States, who can say in my country, it's, you know, I know how they feel. So you did it, Dr. Wetchfing. You hit the nail on the head, and I can't offer you enough kudos and congratulations. And I am going to sit
back
and
invite,
but I will also annoy you with emails about when is the documentary going to start.
No, I look forward.
And anything,
well, I look forward to your emails, and I am applying for funding.
Good. Well, whatever we can do with the National Girls and Women of Color Council, through visibility and through the Interracial Colorism Project, you have our support 100%.
Thank you so much. It really has been such an honor. And it's so nice to have this be the second time I've had a chance to speak with you. You know, the first time it was before the book was even out. And so
that's
it's
right.
Really great to have reconnected with you after so much has happened and after other folks have read the work. So just thank you for being a space that's been open to hearing about colorism from a global perspective, which I think is so important. So you've certainly been supportive in that way, and I'm just really grateful for that.
You're more than welcome. And I just want to say to you, keep doing what you're doing. We need this. We need to see as much of it as you can. Get out there and publish to us, and with all your projects, you are more than, you know, you have a standing open invitation. Any new research projects or endeavors you're working on, you know, you have a home here at Visibility, and you're always welcome here as a guest.
Thank you so much.
So thank you for your time.
That sounds
thank you
wonderful.
So much.
I will be back.
Yes, definitely, and I will be in touch with you and tonight communicate with you through email tonight. And thank you so much.
Sounds
and listeners.
Well, thank you also to your listeners who tuned in.
Yes, thank you. And listeners, don't forget, Dr. Hort Freeman will be back as a guest when we have the show Girls and Women of Color and Colorism. I think it's on the 26th of April. I'll check and make sure I'm correct with the date. But Dr. Hort Freeman, once again, congratulations. Thank you for all of your excellent, outstanding research and for being the change that we need to see when it comes to this colorism issue.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. You have a wonderful evening.
Okay, you too. Good night. Okay, listeners, that wraps up. Good night. That wraps up our show tonight. And next week, you would definitely want to join us also as we continue the series on the dynamics and complexities of colorism. Our guest next week will be Dr. Yaba Blaine. And she is well known throughout everywhere. So we're going to talk about colorism in film and the media and the music industry. So make sure you tune in. We'll be posting and advertising the show over the weekend. Once again, listeners, thank you for tuning in, for supporting Visibility, for your kind words and wonderful emails and little tidbits that you send to me. They mean so much. You as our listener base, always remember your voices are important. We want to hear them. If there are topics that you would love for us to discuss or cover, feel free to shoot me an email, contact me, and just say, hey, Dr. C, can you do a show on this topic? And as I always say at the ending of each show, remember, regardless of what you do, remember to define yourself for yourself and keep rising to the top. Good night, everyone. Thank you for joining us for Visibility with your host, Dr. Donna Maria Culprith. You may contact us at 866-829-0163. We're looking forward to you tuning in next Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Until next week, remember to define yourself for yourself. Dare to be different and dream in color. This is Dr. Culprith signing off for Visibility. Good night.